From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember novelist, scholar, and rabbi Chaim Potok. He died yesterday at the age of 73. His best-known novel, The Chosen, was based on his experiences as a young man leaving the ultra-Orthodox world for a secular life. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview with him. We'll also remember songwriter Matt Dennis, who has died at the age of 88. Some of his best-known songs were associated with Frank Sinatra, like Angel Eyes, Violets for Your Furs, and Everything Happens to Me. The author of Rat Pack Confidential, Sean Levy, has a new book called Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London in the 60s. We'll talk about the book and how that scene affected the Rat Pack. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal agents have arrested five top executives of Adelphia Communications, including the founder of the bankrupt cable company and two of his sons. Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson said John Riga and his family used Adelphia as their personal piggy bank.
The complaint alleges that members of the Riga's family that controlled Adelphia systematically looted the corporation. In less than 4 years, the complaint alleges they stole hundreds of millions of dollars and through their fraud caused losses to investors of more than $60 billion.
Adelphia is the nation's sixth largest cable provider. Independent stock analysts launched a new organization today promising unbiased research for the benefit of investors. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The new Investor Side Research Association is billing itself as an antidote to the conflicts of interest that have plagued some Wall Street analysts. Critics have accused those analysts of hyping even troubled stocks in order to win lucrative investment banking business. Members of the new association must not be connected with investment banks and must work strictly for shareholders. Frank Torres of Consumers Union says independent research is a key ingredient in restoring public faith in the market.
The timing couldn't be more perfect as a way to fill the gap in getting good, solid information and advice to consumers.
The new association was launched with 11 independent research firms. It's been endorsed by former Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Arthur Levitt and U.S. Senator John McCain. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
The Bush administration says the troubled stock market has not diminished the president's support for his proposal to allow Americans to take the money they contribute to Social Security and invest it instead in the stock market. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president's Social Security plan, first unveiled during the 2000 campaign, was criticized as risky even before the recent market downturn. But Press Secretary Ari Fleischer says it's a question of giving people options, that workers should be able to divert a portion of what they contribute to Social Security into private investments.
The president does have faith fundamentally in the ability of people to use their own discretion, make their own judgments, and he thinks that younger workers will welcome the opportunity to have more control of their own money so they can make decisions as they see fit.
But critics say the current volatility on Wall Street clearly demonstrates what is wrong with Mr. Bush's proposal. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 489 points, or more than 6.3%, to close at 8,191 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 61 points. That's nearly 5%. It closed at 1,290. This is NPR News. 19 weeks into the war crimes trial of Slobodan Milosevic, the first close aide to the former Serbian leader took the stand. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from The Hague.
Rade Marković, Milosevic's secret police chief during the Kosovo conflict, appeared in court near the end of today's session. He nodded to his smiling former boss, the defendant, as he entered the courtroom. Under questioning, Marković acknowledged that when Milosevic was particularly interested in something, he would invite the Secret Service chief to his office for further explanations. But the witness stressed that he personally took orders from the Interior Minister, since the Secret Service was not under Milosevic's direct control. The prosecution is counting on testimony by former insiders like Marković to prove Milosevic's chain of command responsibility in war crimes. Marković, long a staunch Milosevic loyalist, is serving a one-year jail sentence in Belgrade for destroying secret police files. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, The Hague.
The Senate has overwhelmingly approved a nearly $29 billion package of measures to fight terrorism. The bill passed on a vote of 92-7 after Senate leaders agreed to trim some of the spending in the measure to avoid a presidential veto. The House passed the bill earlier this afternoon. The measure provides more than $14 billion for defense and intelligence, as well as more than $6 billion for aviation safety and domestic security programs, including the FBI. The dispute over the cost of the bill mostly concerned add-ons for lawmakers' home projects, which had little to do with fighting terrorism. President Bush is expected to sign the measure, although he hasn't conclusively said that he would. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novozoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember the writer, scholar, and rabbi Chaim Potok. He died yesterday of brain cancer. He was 73. Potok wrote about Jewish life in his novels and wrote a history of the Jewish people in his nonfiction book, Wanderings. He also served as editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society and was a member of a committee of scholars that translated the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, into contemporary English. His books include My Name is Asher Lev and The Promise. He first became known for his 1967 bestseller, The Chosen, a semi-autobiographical novel about a teenage boy coming of age in an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic family, struggling with the decision to leave that world for a more secular life. When I spoke with Chaim Potok in 1986, he described his family's religious background.
Ours was a very traditional family. You would categorize it today as a fundamentalist family, devout observance of the Sabbath and the festivals, prayer three times a day, very kosher home. And I attended parochial schools from the time I was about 5 1/2 years old until I was graduated from Yeshiva College, which was a parochial Jewish parochial university at the age of about 20. So that my whole spectrum of early education, elementary school, high school, college, was all within the Orthodox fundamentalist fold. My father and my mother were both members of Hasidic groups. My mother, a descendant of one of the great Hasidic dynasties, a direct descendant of the son of one of the sons of the founder of that dynasty. We call it the Rishiner dynasty in Europe. It was virtually wiped out in the Holocaust. And my father, a member of a Hasidic group called the Belzer Hasidim. I grew up inside that world. I remember the little synagogue in which I prayed from the time I could pray as a little child until my early years in college when problems began to develop.
When you were growing up, was it okay for you to mix with the outside world, or were you expected to keep within the Hasidic community?
I think that's one of the fundamental problems that confronts all people today. That is to say, you grow up inside your own particular world, learn its systems of values, are expected to adhere to those values. But because of the nature of the world in which we live today, very early on you're going to find yourself in confrontation with ideas and values that are going to come to you from outside your small world. In essence, that's what I'm trying to explore in my books, what happens in a confrontation of that kind. And all of us experience that confrontation. It really makes no difference where we come from, whether we brought up religious or whether we're brought up secular. It's a new confrontation. 200 more years ago, most people on this planet never encountered a new idea or a stranger in an entire lifetime, unless you were a member of the aristocracy or the clergy or the military. You lived and you died inside a 25-mile radius of the place where you were born. And never met a stranger or a new idea. This confrontation with new ideas is really new insofar as the experience of our species is concerned. And so very early on, I began to encounter worlds of ideas from outside the tight parameters of my own small Orthodox world. And there was no way that my parents could keep me from that sort of encounter. All you had to do was turn on the radio, open a book that you picked up in a library. The only way you could stop this sort of encounter is by shutting yourself off entirely, and the effort to do that is enormous. Some people do that. Some groups try to do that. We were not in that sort of a world.
Did you ever feel like you were looked at as an object of ridicule by other people.
Oh, yes, there was always that problem of being different from the rest of the world. For example, I always walked around with a skull cap on my head. It was inconceivable that I would go anywhere without that. In the summertime, that's what you wore no matter how hot it might be. You were always the object of attention. You have to remember that I grew up in the 30s. At a period of time in the United States when anti-Semitism was as rampant as you could possibly imagine it to be in the United States and still not be part of the political scene. I grew up at a period of time when Father Kugel's anti-Semitic radio programs would come blaring at us through the open windows in the street where I lived. One was very conscious of one's Jewishness, and at the same time one was very conscious that there were lots of people out there who didn't like you for what it was that you were.
You said a minute ago that it was literature that opened up your experiences beyond the neighborhood that you lived in and beyond the ideas that you got from that neighborhood and from your parents. What were you reading that...
I was about 15 years old when I read for the first time a serious adult novel, quite by chance. I wanted to read an adult novel. I had time on my hands. It was at the end of a high school term for me. I was done with my exams. And for a reason that isn't quite clear to me to this day, I decided I would take a crack at a really tough adult novel. And I went to the library and found, of all things, Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh. It's a story that I've told a number of times. I owe an extraordinary debt to that strange Englishman who's probably as amazed as I am that he affected a nice Jewish boy from New York in the way that he affected him. But I remember reading that story and finding myself utterly lost inside the book, not so much lost inside the storyline as much as I was lost inside the people and their feelings. I had read books before, but always there was a sense of the reading experience. That was the first time in my life when I actually lost sense of the reading experience and found myself feeling the feelings of the people. Now, Brideshead Revisited is about upper-class British Catholics in the decades before the Second World War. I was a yeshiva student, a boy from a Jewish parochial high school, and of course you can imagine that I knew a great deal about upper-class British Catholics. I had never had a reading experience of that kind before. I remember closing the book, looking down at it, and feeling utter amazement at the power of the human imagination that could create a so vivid a world that a reader from so distant a world could find himself utterly lost inside that world. And that's where the commitment to write was born. I don't fully understand it to this day. Things happen to teenagers sometimes. They pass and are dissipated. And sometimes what happens so locks with the inner being of the teenager that dreams are born and you spend the rest of your life trying to chase that dream. And that's what happened to me. It's very difficult to be filled with this kind of experience and not have it in one way or another alter your way of structuring the human experience. By the time I was 18, 19, going into my 20s, I began to feel that if I was going to be a serious writer, it would really be impossible for me to remain inside a fundamentalist world with very rigid, structured parameters and find full expression for what it is that I wanted to say.
Did you take an action that was your first big symbolic break with your past and with that tradition?
The action was very overt, very blunt, and it came a few months before I was graduated from Yeshiva University, which was and is an Orthodox school, although a modern Orthodox school, rather a sophisticated school. I was asked to stay on at Yeshiva University after graduation and teach in the English department there. I was majoring in English. And instead of doing that, I decided to go to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, which is a non-Orthodox, non-fundamentalist rabbinical school. And I went there not to become a rabbi. I went there in order to learn another angle of vision on the Jewish tradition. I knew by the time I was about 18 or 19 years old that I would write about Jews. What else did I know to write about? I didn't know what I would write about, but I knew that I would write about the Jewish experience. And I also knew that I was getting essentially an Eastern European education, which is essentially a fundamentalist education. And I also knew that there had to be whole elements of the Jewish tradition, whole elements of Jewish civilization that I was simply not being taught in my fundamentalist world. Where was its philosophy, its poetry, its storytelling? Now, where was the whole spectrum of Jewish civilization? The only thing I was being taught was Talmud. And at that time, my cousin married a student at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and we began to talk. And I decided that I would go to the Jewish Theological Seminary because that was the place where I would get a Western scientific orientation to the Jewish tradition. And in retrospect, it was one of the better choices that I made in my life, because what it did was fill me in on whole areas of Jewish learning, Jewish thought, and the Jewish experience that I simply wasn't receiving before. What it did essentially was give the Jewish experience a historical dimension. And that's what you need very, very much if you're going to be a serious writer.
Let me ask you a weird question here. How come you didn't leave religion altogether? Because you made a break with your past, but you kept with religion. You remained very religious and very, very committed to the Jewish tradition.
My feeling is that if there were no alternatives to orthodoxy or fundamentalism in the Jewish tradition, as, for example, there were no alternatives for James Joyce with his Catholicism, that I probably would have left the Jewish tradition entirely. The point is that I had an alternative. I had a non-fundamentalist reading of the Jewish tradition that I went to. I did not have to go the way of James Joyce.
Did your parents perceive this as an attack on them and their families and their heritage?
My father was very unhappy with the choice, but of course I was of an age where he could do nothing about it. I think that he didn't quite make his peace with that choice.
So it must have been hard for you.
It was very hard. It was also hard because when you make a choice of this kind, you really break with your past entirely. You wipe out your whole early life. It's interesting that friends don't talk to you anymore. Teachers don't talk to you anymore. It's as if you have to rebuild your life entirely. It's quite as if you are suddenly without a history. It isn't just a matter of changing schools. It is a matter of changing worlds. And it was a very difficult choice to make.
We're listening back to a 1986 interview with Chaim Potok. He died yesterday at the age of 73. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist, Jewish scholar, and rabbi Chaim Potok died yesterday at the age of 73 of brain cancer. We're listening back to a 1986 interview with him. After studying to become a rabbi and then after being ordained, you decided to never actually take on a congregation and to write instead. Can you explain that decision?
Well, I had always wanted to write, and I was going to the seminary in order to learn my subject better. I never intended to be a pulpit rabbi and have never been a pulpit rabbi. I don't think I could have been a pulpit rabbi and been a writer simultaneously. I think being a pulpit rabbi is an enormous commitment and is a total drain of one's creative energies, and I don't see how anybody could possibly do both creatively. I really became an educated Jew, as it were, a Western educated Jew, for the purpose of knowing my subject better. Indeed, just as I later on went to the University of Pennsylvania and took a doctorate in general philosophy in order to learn better the general civilization about which I was going to write, because I'm writing about the confrontation of those two civilizations.
Then I guess the closest you came to having a congregation was when you were a chaplain in the army during the Korean War.
That was precisely right. That's the closest I came to actually having a congregation, and it was, I must say, an extraordinary experience. The year and a half I spent in Korea, a few years after the end of the war, when things were still very bad there.
What made it extraordinary for you?
The intense feelings of people, the meeting of rather terrible conditions of all kinds of human beings, the commitments that one makes in periods of great stress, the friendships that one forms. Things happen on fields of combat that simply don't happen in ordinary life, and relationships are born that still hold for me. Some of my closest, deepest, most marvelous friendships were formed in that period of time.
It certainly took you far away from the world you'd been brought up in.
Everything that I brought with me to Korea disintegrated under the impetus of that confrontation. I brought a very neat, coherent model of my Americanism and my Judaism there. And nothing was the same when I came back home. I met, interestingly enough, a world where Judaism simply doesn't figure as a category of thought. I had always been brought up to believe that Judaism was crucial in Western civilization, as indeed it was. One cannot conceive of Western civilization without its Jewish component. And there I lived for 15 and a half months in a civilization where Judaism simply doesn't figure at all, and it gets along very well without Judaism. It doesn't need it at all. I had always been brought up to believe that paganism was an abomination. And I lived among pagans, and it is not an abomination. There are some things about the pagan world that are absolutely exquisite.
What do you mean when you say pagan?
A civilization that is essentially idolatrous, where the focal point is nature, cycles of nature, and images and idols that are representative of those cycles of nature. Fructification of the earth, the agricultural cycle, the natural cycle, and so on. It's a beautiful world, and there is much in it that I fell profoundly in love with. I remember, for example, wandering through Tokyo once and stopping off at a Shinto shrine in a market district and seeing there an old man praying before an idol, Shinto idol, dressed in a bedraggled coat and a felt hat and a brownish suit, and holding in his hands some sort of prayer book and shaking back and forth in front of the idol. And I looked at him, and the first thing I remembered were the old Jews that I used to pray with in this little Hasidic synagogue that I grew up in. And I remember asking myself at that point, what am I looking at? Is the God that I pray to listening to this man's prayers? If the God that I pray to is not listening to this man's prayers, why not? Because I cannot conceive of a human being praying with greater devotion than I was witnessing in that Japanese man at that point. And if the God that I pray to is listening to this man's prayers, then what are Judaism and Christianity all about? So I came away from the Far East with a spectrum of questions to which, to this day, I don't have full answers. And what happened was that my whole world was rendered ambiguous. And it is this world that I'm trying to explore in my fiction. And what I did was I started backwards. I began to explore the components of that fixed world that I brought with me to Korea, and slowly began to experiment with and explore the world that I actually encountered in Korea and what happened when those two worlds met.
The first novel that you wrote was The Chosen.
That's right.
What were some of the personal and religious themes that you were wrestling with at the time that ended up in your novel, The Chosen?
I was wrestling essentially with the problem of what happens when an individual who grows up inside the core of a particular tradition, knows that tradition really well, attended its best schools, and is committed to that tradition, loves it, comes up at the same time against elements from the general civilization in which we all live, and finds himself passionately committed to those elements. Isn't quite sure why, but suddenly these elements open tremendous windows, powerful personal visions into the nature of the world or the nature of man. And The Chosen particularly deals with Freudian psychoanalytic theory, which is thoroughly inimical to any Western religion's view of the human being, man, and his relationship to other men, and so on and so forth. That's the essential thrust of The Chosen. In other words, how do you come to terms with a system of ideas that seems to be hostile to your own system of ideas, and at the same time, you see in that hostile system of ideas elements of real truth, of profound insight into the nature of man, that your own system of ideas doesn't have. What do you do in a situation of this kind when you find yourself falling in love with opposites? Opposites. That was the essential thrust of The Chosen. It's an intellectual problem. I deal with it on a feeling level, because novels shouldn't be enterprises or experiments of the intellect as much as they really should be explorations of human relations and human feelings. And I'm interested in the feeling component of this kind of culture confrontation. And as I said earlier, all of us have experiences of this kind because all of us come from particular worlds and bump up against ideas from worlds outside our own.
Your life and your literature has been an attempt to understand your own tradition and find a way for you to kind of communicate within your own religion, and at the same time to respect other religions and other worldviews, other cultures, and not accept one as the ultimate truth, thereby negating any validity that the other has. Do you feel like you've been able to actually do that in your life?
I think so, yes. I think I have a very profound commitment to two systems of thought simultaneously. One, my place as an American, and simultaneous with that, my place as a Jew who tries very hard to come to terms with the most fruitful areas of modern life. I think that the best way that you encounter the world is by taking from it the best that it has to offer you, enriching yourself as a result, and then giving that combination back to the world. That constant mixture of fruitful elements is really what human civilization ought to be about.
Do you think a lot of cultures and a lot of religions kind of breed a certain chauvinism, that this is the one and this is the best and don't really trust the others?
Yes, I think that's an infantilistic element of the human being, the notion that what I am is better than what you are. I think it's something that we had better learn to outgrow as quickly as possible, because if we keep that up, we're not going to be around for too long to brag about our own particular way of seeing the world.
Chaim Potok, recorded in 1986. He died yesterday of brain cancer. He was 73. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we remember songwriter Matt Dennis. He wrote Angel Eyes, Let's Get Away From It All, and Everything Happens to Me. He's died at the age of 88. Also, we look back at Austin Powers' favorite time and place, swinging London in the 60s. We talk with Sean Levy, author of the new book, Ready, Steady, Go. Ready, Steady, Go is a new book about the time and place Austin Powers would be most at home in, swinging London in the 60s. Author Sean Levy says that in the 60s, London rose from a prim and fusty capital to the fashionable center of the modern world. His book is centered around the city's music, fashion, and social life, focusing on the lives of several people who helped create that scene, including Mick Jagger, the Beatles manager Brian Epstein, hairdresser Vidal Sassoon, fashion designer Mary Quant, and actors Michael Caine and Terrence Stamp. Sean Levy is also the author of the book Rat Pack Confidential. I asked him what set the stage for the cultural explosion in London.
In the 50s, Britain had a really tough time recovering economically from World War II. While Germany and Italy were being rebuilt with the help of American money, France was recovering. The U.S. obviously was enjoying a very fecund period of commercial and even cultural growth. England was kind of stagnant until about the middle of the decade, when you had the advent of sort of the angry young men in theater and literature. You had a growth and prosperity that allowed families who had, you know, been living in houses with outdoor bathrooms and, the whole family crammed into two upstairs rooms, were able to afford a larger home, move to the country, that sort of thing, the suburbs. And the young people of that generation uniquely did not have to serve in the military. They were the first generation of Britons to be freed from the obligation to serve national service. There were art schools that were now part of the national education program. So if you weren't going to go on to college or university, as we would say, you could attend an art school and maybe learn painting or music. So a number of factors started to come together at the end of the 50s. And then there were a few places in London where the prosperity, the access, to, you know, the leisure time that young people had, the work that young people suddenly had, they were actually making more money in a lot of cases than their parents, sort of all came together. But it was about 1961, 62, even into the beginning of 63, that there was clearly something going on in England that was unique in the world. You know, if you look at American kid music shows of that time from television, the audience looks very square. You know, they could be watching Patti Page 6 or 7 years earlier. And you look at the British kids in 62, 63, and they look hip.
What are they wearing?
Well, the boys are wearing something like mod. It was skinny ties and lapels, very nicely cut suits. They had their hair done at hairdressers, not barbers. The girls were wearing shorter skirts. They had their hair cut shorter. They were wearing bolder colors, both the boys and the girls. All of that was new to England. And it was really, it would have been novel in America. You talk to some of the swinging Londoners about the first time they wore their gear to America, and they talk about getting stares for wearing things that nobody would have blinked at in London.
You mentioned that you were familiar before writing this book with the fashions and movies and music that came out of London in the 60s. What are some of those key cultural moments for you that define London in the 60s?
Well, two of the very early innovators are Mary Quant, the fashion designer, and Vidal Sassoon, the hair cutter. And you know, we've come to think of Vidal Sassoon in particular as kind of like a goof, you know, with his blow dryers and shampoos. But here was a guy who, in the late 50s, began to rebel against the tradition of hair dressing, of setting hair into place several times a week with gels and heat and expensive treatments and having women sleep sitting up so that they wouldn't look bad the next day and things like this. He figured out how to cut hair so that you didn't have to go to the hair salon more than once a month, say, so that your hair would be cut into the shape you wanted, so that it was much freer and looser. Mary Quant, similarly, using sort of the techniques and quality of couture fashion, designed sort of sporty city clothes, things that made young women look sensual and made them look different from their mothers. And that was a lot of it, that, you know, these young people had money and didn't want to be like their parents any longer. In music, I think the Beatles are a similar sort of thing, taking materials that had already been there and injecting it with a kind of verve that was new. In cinema, the Beatles' first film, of course, A Hard Day's Night, but at the same time you had British films, you know, of more serious weight, things like Tom Jones and The Leather Boys by Sidney Furie, that felt more like continental films than like American films. So there were a number of things that were happening in England first.
So one of the things that's interesting for me about this period is during part of this period, I'm a preteener growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and getting my like yellow miniskirt at the department store and having the neighborhood hairdresser give me his version of a Sassoon and a Sassoon haircut. And it's just interesting how all this stuff just like filters down to, you know, kids growing up in Brooklyn and all over the United States.
Yeah, it really was infectious, you know, and it wasn't offensive the way, say, you know, long hair and burn your bra at the end of the 60s was to the older generation. The irony is so much of Swinging London was inspired by America, the pop music. You know, people like James Dean and Elvis Presley were revered by the British, and they couldn't believe that they weren't as loved in America by the mid-60s as they were in England. Sassoon described Swinging London to me as the marriage of American genres with a continental sensibility, the French grafted onto the American as interpreted by the British.
My guest is Sean Levy, author of the new book Ready, Steady, Go. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Sean Levy, is the author of the new book, Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London in the 60s. He's also the author of the book, Rat Pack Confidential. I asked him to talk about what the Rat Pack was up to during the Swinging London era.
Well, of course, the Rat Pack, they were all older gentlemen, married with kids in most cases, and they were taking part of a different sort of license. You know, they had this kind of public image as swinging guys and, you know, sort of men's men, and they appealed to that sort of greatest generation. You know, they were the age of people who would have fought in World War II and become the sort of men in the gray flannel suit in America. And they had adult tastes. And, you know, it's funny. Sinatra's womanizing was part of his appeal, you know, to an audience in the early 60s, that he was unmarried and had this enviable life. The Beatles had to pretend that John Lennon wasn't married, and Mick Jagger used to hide his girlfriend, Chrissy Shrimpton, because they wanted to put forward a face of being youthful and clean and free and available. The Rat Pack owned things. You know, Sinatra owned the Sands Hotel, or part of it, and Dean Martin owned part of it. He owned a record company. He produced movies. The Beatles didn't even own their likeness. It was sold away to a kind of sharp character from London, and then a couple of companies in England and the U.S., and they lost hundreds of millions of dollars until they formed Apple and got it back. So there was a certain sophistication to the Rat Pack's party that the Swinging London people just didn't have. You know, I don't think a lot of them thought that it would be going on as long as it did. You see Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and The Who on stage today, and you couldn't imagine in 1965 that they would be doing it in 1970.
Now, you write a little bit about the Rolling Stones. In writing about the Rolling Stones, you focus on Mick Jagger, and what you really emphasize in Mick Jagger's background is this suburban upbringing, that this is a real, like, middle-class suburban kid who gets deeply involved with African-American rhythm and blues. Why emphasize the suburban middle-class aspect of his background?
Well, one of the great things about Swinging London that British people remember is that it was a time when the class system, which is so rigid in England, even really today, from the Queen down, was fractured. It wasn't broken. It wasn't scuttled. But there were perforations in it that there had never been before. So you could get working class people like some of the Beatles, like Vidal Sassoon, who grew up in an orphanage because his mother couldn't afford to keep him in the house. They were suddenly celebrities, and they were able to rub elbows with the daughters of dukes and duchesses. And Jagger was in a funny position. Mary Quant says that the smart thing to be was either very high or very low. The middle was dull. And Jagger came from the middle. He's in ways a fellow who had to sort of pretend to be more common than he was. But at the same time, when he was a hit, he had to then learn how to be with people who were from a higher station in life. And he has done that dance, that tightrope walk, more and more successfully than any of these other figures.
Now, one of the early Rolling Stones appearances in the United States was on the Hollywood Palace, which was a variety show in the 60s. And I believe that Dean Martin was hosting it the night
That's
that
right.
they were on. Is that like a real pivotal point for you, having written a book about the Rat Pack and a book about London in the 60s?
And about Jerry Lewis, whose theater that was. He
built
that theater
okay.
for his 1963 TV show.
So what does that moment embody for you? Dean Martin introducing the Rolling Stones on Hollywood Palace.
Well, he didn't only introduce them. He practically slandered them. He said, aren't they pretty? Don't leave me backstage with them. And he says, that isn't long hair. It's just high eyebrows and low foreheads. And later in the show, there was a trampolinist on, and Dean said, this guy is the Rolling Stones' father. He's been trying to kill himself ever since. And the Stones didn't hear any of that because they were in the green room, and they saw it a week later when they were in Chicago, and they were incensed. Bill Wyman told me Mick Jagger got on the phone and was yelling at their management in England that, you know, we'll never do this again. But it really is, you know, sort of a place where the two cultures, the aging dinosaur culture of great American showbiz, nightclubs, and the Borscht Belt and Hollywood is meeting this youth quake that it cannot stop. And let it be said in Dean's defense that when the Beatles had all those number one hits in 1964, the record that finally knocked them to number two was Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime.
Some things are inexplicable.
Yeah. Dean is my good luck charm. I can't write a book without him.
In the United States, most youth movements are met with some kind of adult or conservative adult backlash. Was there a backlash in London in the early 60s?
You know, there wasn't, not in the sense that there was here. And again, it's partly the difference between the two cultures. The British 60s was in large measure about joining in people from the north of England, people from the east end of London, lower class people, people who might have otherwise been sort of fringe characters or had no real shot, were able to belly up to the bar, come to the party, and be part of the scene. Someone like Terence Stamp telling me, you know, without the 60s, he would have never been able to date the daughter of the Duke of Bedford. In America, the 60s, as we think of it more, was about protest and dropping out. So there was much more of a generation gap in the States, I believe, than in London. Also, the first phase of the 60s in England was smart. You could be a mod kid, spend all night in a nightclub in London on amphetamines, and show up at the next day at a bank for work because the way to look was to look good in a suit and have a nice haircut. You rode a Vespa, you looked like a responsible young lad. So it didn't quite give off the same creepy vibe that, say, a hippie did later on.
What ends this period in London's life?
Well, the drugs. Drugs changed everything in the 60s in the States as well as in England. You know, if you read histories of the Haight-Ashbury, it's a little later and it's a little more severe even. The economics of England changed. In 1963, England had one of the most robust economies in the world. In 1966, the Labor government put a wage and price freeze on. So that narrowed down the opportunities. One of the people I interviewed told me that in the early 60s, everyone had a job. If you were a photographer, a model, a musician, by the end of the 60s, there were fewer jobs to be had. And the people who had shown over time that they could do quality work reliably and repeatedly were the ones who kept working. Sassoon, Mary Quant, the photographer David Bailey, the Beatles, Michael Caine, and the ones who were flaky and difficult to deal with or really didn't have much talent sort of drifted away. So it became smaller. Taxes drove a lot of these people out. The government started taxing people in certain professions at like 90%. So rock bands and actors had to leave to you know, keep their money. And the climate changed in such a way that the British no longer had the monopoly. You know, for a few years, if anyone looked cool, they were English. People like Bob Dylan, Andy Warhol, Allen Ginsberg went to London to see what was happening. And the mode of being, the hippie influence that started coming in at the end of the 60s really wasn't the same vibe any longer. Swinging London was about, you know, looking chic and going to nightclubs and dancing next to the genius whose record you were listening to and things like that. And hippie was more about, you know, getting back to the earth and, you know, being free and wearing loose clothes. You can't do hippie in Hyde Park in January.
Now, your book is coming out at about the same time as the new Austin Powers movie. And, of course, Austin Powers just really spoofed the whole London in the 60s thing. Do you like the Austin Powers films? Did they at all inform your direction for the book? I mean, did you take any inspiration from that?
Well, it made it easy to explain to people in America what I was doing. Everyone in England, if you say the 60s, thinks about Swinging London. Everyone in America thinks about Haight-Ashbury. So if I said it's Austin Powers nonfiction, everybody got it. And the genius of the Austin Powers conceit is that he gets all the cliches. It's partly a Bond movie. It's partly What's New Pussycat, which was partly made in England in the 60s. But it's done in a very gently mocking way in the style of the 60s. That first Austin Powers film has those little interstitial bits where Mike Myers is with some go-go dancers and they just freeze frame and then they go back to the story. That feels so much like The Knack and How to Get It or A Hard Day's Night or Help. That's, I think, the brilliant thing, to parody it in the form that the original took.
Well, Sean Levy, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Sean Levy is the author of the new book, Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London. Coming up, we remember Matt Dennis, who wrote the songs Angel Eyes and Everything Happens to Me. This is Fresh Air. We learned today that composer Matt Dennis died last month at the age of 88. He wrote some great songs, Everything Happens to Me, Angel Eyes, Violets for Your Furs, Let's Get Away from It All, and The Night We Called It a Day. Early in his career, in the 1940s, he worked for Tommy Dorsey's band as a staff arranger and composer. Dorsey's singer at the time was Frank Sinatra. Sinatra made the definitive recordings of several Dennis songs. We phoned Matt Dennis in 1995 on the occasion of Sinatra's 80th birthday to ask him about this song.
Hey, drink up, all you people, and order anything you see. Have fun. You happy people, the drink and the laughs on me. Try to think that love's not around. Still, it's uncomfortably near. My old heart ain't gaining any ground, because my angel eyes ain't here.
Matt Dennis, welcome to Fresh Air.
How do you do?
How did Frank Sinatra end up recording your song, Angel Eyes?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Jimmy Van Heusen, the famous songwriter, was a friend of mine, and he had done, he was preparing an album, producing it for Frank, called Only the Lonely. And he talked, told Frank about the song, and Frank really liked it. So it was very nice. He accepted the song, and I was so pleased that he used it. And I was more than pleased because there were a couple of memorable times when his version of it was quite startling. I don't know if you recall, a few years ago in the 70s, he had made up his mind he was going to retire and
right.
quit the business, and he did a final concert at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, and his final song was Angel Eyes, and very dramatically, he had the lights go off on him as he walked off the stage at the end of the song, where he used my line, "Excuse me while I disappear." And as he sang that last line, he disappeared, and it made the papers, I think, all over the world. It was a strange thing. They thought Frank was giving it up. And, of course, old Blue Eyes came back, as we all know.
Mm-hmm. Did Frank Sinatra do anything surprising with Angel Eyes?
Yes, it was his idea to start with the middle of the song, like an attention-getting line of the song, where it said, "Drink up, all you people." And it was very strong, and it set an example because it was copied by other singers all over the place. Very emotionally strong. And then he did that out of tempo dramatically, and then he went into the main theme of the song. And, of course, he repeated the middle that he just sung in the construction of the song as he went through it. But it was just great the way he did it. Drink up, all you people. Order anything you see. It was like he was talking to people firsthand, and I think that really caught the people's eyes, you know, and ears. That's what caught it.
You started working with Sinatra very early in his career, in the early 40s when he was still with Dorsey. Did you have any idea that he'd go on to become as popular, as important, as good as he did?
Oh, yes. After the success of a couple of my songs with Dorsey, the writing was on the wall as far as I was concerned, not only for my songs, but for the way he was doing things. Because he had a sound, and his sound was very smooth, and it was a sound that was bound to catch on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for helping us to celebrate Frank Sinatra's birthday, and I also want to thank you for all the great songs you've written.
Well, thank you very much for appreciating it, and I'm in touch with Frank quite often, and he's one and only, you know. That's all I can say. He's great.
Songwriter Matt Dennis recorded on the occasion of Frank Sinatra's 80th birthday. Dennis died last month at the age of 88. Matt Dennis was also a singer and pianist. Here he is singing his own song. The lyric is by Tom Adair.
I make a date for golf, and you can bet your life it rains. Try to give a party, and the guy upstairs complains. Guess I'll go through life just catching colds and missing trains. Everything happens to me. I never miss a thing. I've had the measles and the mumps. And every time I play an ace, my partner always trumps. Guess I'm just a fool who never looks before he jumps. Everything happens to me. At first my heart thought you would break this jinx for me, that love would turn the trick to end despair. But now I just can't fool this head that thinks for me. I've mortgaged all my castles in the air. I've telegraphed and phoned, sent an airmail special to. Your answer was goodbye, and there was even postage due. I fell in love just once, and then it had to be with you. Everything happens to me. I try to sing a song and then the conversation flows. So I sing a little stronger than the wearing mixer goes. The wearing mixer goes. Just got his car and he's very happy. And then to top it off, somebody has to blow his nose, please. Everything happens to me. So then I make a movie, though it's little claim to fame. The part was very tiny, didn't even see my name. But I clicked my scenes off perfectly, and the cutter did the same. Everything happens to me. And when the room is loaded with celebrities, magazine photographers come in. They're busy filming all of those festivities, while here I sit with gravy on my chin. So then I write a song that the publishers avoid, but the record companies take a chance, so I am overjoyed. But it never gets a play. It's on the back of Jimmy Boyd. Everything happens to me. Everything happens to me.
Matt Dennis performing his song, Everything Happens to Me. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another song composed by Matt Dennis.
Let's take a boat to Bermuda. Let's take a plane to St. Paul. Let's grab a kayak to Quincy or Niagara. Let's get away from it all. Let's take a trip in a trailer. No need to come back at all. Let's take a powder to Boston for chowder. Let's get away from it all. We'll travel around from town to town. We'll visit every state. I repeat, I love you, sweet, in all the 48. Let's go again to Niagara. This time we'll peek at the fall. Let's leave our hut, dear, get out of our rut, dear. Let's get away from it all. We'll travel around from town to town. We'll visit.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, WorldCom, Enron, Arthur Andersen. We talk with journalist Kurt Eichenwald, who writes about white-collar crime and corporate corruption for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.